Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, a renewed push for statehood. On Monday, the case for making the District of Columbia a state took center stage in front of the U.S. House Committee on Oversight and Reform. The district's mayor argued the city's taxpaying residents deserve federal representation, as Congress considers a bill that would do just that. At the same time, the call for Puerto Rico statehood is getting a boost from advocates in the Capitol. So, what are the arguments for and against expanding the Union? And how do these efforts compare to how the country added states in the past? I spoke with Paul Frymer, professor of politics at Princeton University and author of Building an American Empire, the Era of Territorial and Political Expansion. Paul, this week the House Oversight and Reform Committee held a meeting on the push for D.C. statehood. Bring us up to date on this effort.
Yeah, so yesterday the House began some hearings on it, and it was officially proposed. This is an expected move by the Democratic Party to push D.C. statehood, and the process began yesterday with some opening arguments by both parties outlining where they're headed, the Democratic Party pushing D.C. statehood as an important historic act that will give full suffrage and democratic representation to a population that has long been underserved and denied full access to all the aspects of our democracy. And the Republicans have raised constitutional issues, and they've raised problems about D.C. not having industry, not having an airport. So a lot of different arguments coming out from the Republicans. But namely, they are arguing this is a power grab by the Democrats to add two more senators to the Senate.
And of course, you now know that President Biden is in support of this. How much of a difference does that make?
You know, I mean, if he didn't support it, that'd be a huge difference, right? So, and President Obama did not certainly make it a priority, and clearly, you know, he didn't give much support for it. So it is notable that President Biden is doing this. D.C. statehood has been a topic for quite a while, and there have been plenty of Democrats that have passed on this.
So, you know, we've got 700,000 residents, and this push for statehood has been going on locally for decades, but now getting national attention. How come?
Well, part of it is Black Lives Matter, which has again resurfaced the fact that D.C. is not just a city of 700,000 people, but a city of a long history of African-American thriving populations. Going back to Abraham Lincoln's emancipation of D.C. early in the Civil War, which led to a large Black population moving to D.C., and that has long existed. And to this day, you know, is nearly a majority of the district. So that is a critical matter. And then the addition is the fights right now between Democrats and Republicans about the Senate and generally about the ways Republicans have a skewed advantage from some of our institutions, the Electoral College, the Senate, you know, among them. And so D.C. and potentially somewhere like Puerto Rico offer the Democrats some additional senators to balance the fact that, you know, Republicans have a lot of advantages out west, especially in some of those big territorial states, but small populations, the Wyomings, North Dakotas, South Dakotas, so forth. So those are the two big reasons, Black Lives Matter and the representational issues for the Democrats.
So through the years, there's been a lot of talk about carving out a federal enclave. How would that work?
Yeah, it almost reminds me of the Vatican. You know, because the Vatican's not in Rome, right? It's not even in Italy.
Right. It's a separate city unto itself.
That's right. So I think that's kind of the idea what this enclave would be. It would stretch at least to the Supreme Court and back through, you know, some of the executive branches, through the White House, the Mall, and that would be separate from the state of Washington, D.C.
But I mean, what difference would that make? Why would that be important?
Yeah, I guess it's a good question. I guess it's the national government. So you can imagine maybe like in January, you know, with the insurrection at the Capitol, is that a responsibility of D.C. police, the state police, or should there be something that is the federal government, federal territory? We do have federal territory around the United States, even within other states. You know, we have federal parks, we have federal lands. So this is not, a totally radical idea. You know, to me, it sounds somewhat sensible that you could carve out a space where people really aren't living, that is just the national government offices, and you would label it, you know, something different than D.C. To me, it doesn't bother me one way or the other too much, but I could see carving that out.
Now, think back to the comments that Senator Tom Cotton, Republican of Arkansas, made. He contrasted Washington, D.C. to Wyoming. Talk about those comments.
There's a long argument, right, that the real people of America are out there in the rural areas, right? All of our truck commercials, right? These are the real Americans. Now, in all those commercials, and when Cotton's talking about it, we're talking about white people. And whiteness is so embedded in our society, we may not even be thinking of it directly when we say it, right? Are the truck companies that advertise this thinking that directly, or are they just thinking this, the kind of rugged American individual, the American settler? The American settler was white, right? This is something really deeply embedded in us. And Washington, D.C., you can counter it both in a non-racialized way, that Washington, D.C. is, you know, full of politicians and full of lobbyists and full of corruption and, you know, all those things. But also, it is a city nationally understood as a largely African-American city, and it has representations. You go back to the 80s and 90s, and, you know, Marion Barry, the mayor there, who was, you know, right, the issue with crack cocaine and the violence that was portrayed in D.C. This is how D.C. is portrayed. It's portrayed in the same way that Donald Trump raised with Philadelphia and Detroit and these, you know, large minority or majority African-American cities that are seen as lawless, that are seen as corrupt, that are seen as not representative of America. Right, that is how they are perceived, or how they are pushing this idea, and that, you know, is a way that Cotton and others are trying to negate D.C. as a state. This has been a historical issue. Is when people don't want a state, they say they can't govern themselves. They're corrupt. They don't have an economy that works. They don't have they don't know how to participate in American society more broadly. So Cotton is raising issues that have been out there forever, and we've heard them going all the way back to Louisiana, close to Cotton's territory. Louisiana came in as the first Catholic, French Catholic state in a Protestant nation, and there were arguments that French Catholics, they had a different way of understanding democracy, they had a different form of law, they had civil law as opposed to our common law, they had different beliefs about race and about miscegenation and other issues. So this is an old, old theme, and Cotton is raising it, and, you know, this fits with the dog whistles, the loud dog whistles of the last, you know, 5 years or so.
Senator Cotton also talked about Washington, D.C.'s leadership being too liberal toward the recent protests.
Right. Again, that the city is a black city beholden to African-Americans, run by African-Americans, that they are not representative of the United States. And this is something, this came up with Hawaii when Hawaii became a state. This came up with New Mexico when it became a state. When there are large, strong racial minorities in the population, this comes up. I mean, interestingly enough, on the issue of whiteness, you know, Wisconsin became a state with a very large minority of German citizens or people who spoke German and had just recently moved from Germany. And this didn't come up. So, I mean, there were a couple of mumblings, but it didn't come up. So race is ever present here, and race has been ever present, obviously, in Washington, D.C., again, going back at least to emancipation of slaves there. This is what Cotton is engaging.
for Washington, D.C., when Tom Cotton claims that there's no industry here. Government is the industry.
Government is the industry. That's right. And, you know, there's also a lot of small business. I will say, you know, industry is something that came up in statehood debates, you know, natural resources and so forth. But come on. I mean, every state is different. Every state has different possibilities. And that's not something that arguably has ever been a priority.
Are you personally in favor of making D.C. a state?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Why?
Because you have 700,000 people that don't have full representation. And because D.C. is historically an African-American, or labeled as an African-American city, with a strong African-American presence, it would be the largest African-American population proportionally as a state. I think that sends a strong message historically that the United States is embracing racial equality. It's engaging with its historical legacy. So I think those are two absolutely profound reasons why D.C. should be and should have always been a state, or certainly have been a state since it's had a significant population.
What differences for D.C. citizens would occur with statehood?
Well, they can vote for a senator who would vote and a House member who could vote. So that's a big piece. You know, as a state, you have certain institutional resources. You know, Mayor Bowser has said repeatedly that they don't have the resources to have an adequate police force to have and to adequately protect themselves as a population. So all of that would change. I mean, having voting rights in the Senate, you know, and in the House, I mean, that just adds an enormity. I mean, House members and senators are very powerful people. And especially, I mean, let's, you know, D.C. is a city currently that is skewed towards one party, the Democrats. Let's say it stays a very strong Democratic party. Let's say that Congress maintains its seniority rules. You start to see some pretty powerful representatives in the Senate and the House of Washington, D.C. And, you know, powerful representatives in both houses, they give a lot of money to their states. I mean, all members help their states. So there's all sorts of features here. And this, as a state, it could start to negotiate business. It could start, I mean, it just opens up so much.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Paul Frymer.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here is the rest of my conversation with Paul Frymer. He's professor of politics at Princeton University and author of Building an American Empire, the Era of Territorial and Political Expansion. So there's talk of pairing D.C. with Puerto Rico. How does that work? Does it change the thinking of any Republicans?
Well, you know, historically, that's been a way a lot of our states have come in, as pairs. And a lot of that has been partisan. Some of that was about slavery, going back, you know, before the Civil War. The United States would bring in a slave state and a free state. So the idea has been out there. Puerto Rico is certainly more appealing to the Republicans as a partisan matter than D.C. is. D.C. is a very strong Democratic Party, would be a very strong Democratic Party state. Puerto Rico currently has a Republican non-voting member of Congress. Puerto Rico has a strong tradition of Republican local politicians, mayors, governors, and so forth. It has had support from a number, you know, like Marco Rubio and others, especially in Florida and other places where Puerto Ricans have substantial numbers in the U.S. So the Republicans have reason to believe that Puerto Rico is a place they'd be competitive in. I mean, if they could bring in a Republican state, that would soften D.C. for them, right? So Puerto Rico is certainly not ideal. It would lean Democrat, but it's competitive, and there is Republican support for it.
And how do Puerto Ricans feel about this?
Well, that too is a complicated matter, right? So recently they had a referendum that showed a small majority favored it, I think 53%. Historically, Puerto Ricans, you know, there's been support, but it's always been hovering usually just below 50%. A lot of Puerto Ricans do not want to be a part of the United States. A lot of Puerto Ricans don't want U.S. citizenship. They want to be a separate nation, independent of the United States. So right now, there is majority support, but it is slim. And that's something, you know, that Democrats, as well as Republicans, are bringing up. Is this something the Puerto Ricans want?
So give us a little bit of the background and the history on Puerto Rico, how it became what it did without statehood.
So Puerto Rico was brought into the United States as part of late 19th, early 20th century, when the United States was embarking on being an empire going across seas. So Philippines, it was attempting Cuba, you get Guam, many of the islands, and Puerto Rico was a part of that. The United States, for a while, debated what to do with these new so-called territories. And statehood came up very early on because, you know, in the United States, so the United States has always been, in a sense, an empire, right? Because we've always had territories. Our first territories were Ohio and the Northwest Territory, and we had territories south. So almost every state that wasn't a part of the first 13,
right.
Almost, not all, Texas is not an example of this, almost every state came in as a territory. And so then it had territorial status. And territorial status meant that you would move towards statehood. And so it was sort of the sense of an incubation period, right, where you get enough of a population, you get enough of an industry, you are Americanized, whatever that would mean, right, and then you apply for statehood and you become a state. And so, you know, the territories that have struggled, New Mexico is the lengthiest, and that is because, you know, most directly, it had a very large indigenous population and a very large mestizos population that spoke Spanish and was seen as not American. Indian Territory, of course, never became a state until the rush of white settlers into Oklahoma and turned it into Oklahoma. So that is, generally the idea behind it. Now, Puerto Rico, again, was similar to Indian Territory, to places like Hawaii that were seen as not white enough. And I'll tell you, you know, in the 19th, early 20th century, when they talked about this, like Hawaii, they talked very actively about white people moving to Hawaii. And I'm using these are their words, right? These were white people. They talked about white people moving to New Mexico, white people moving to Arizona. And they talked about, you know, things like, is Puerto Rico white or is it not? And is Cuba white? Is Cancun, is that white? So they had these debates over and over and over. Puerto Rico right away was seen as not part of the United States racially, demographically. And so it sat there as this territory. And then, you know, over the years, statehood has come up in different ways. What the United States has done instead is it initially provided a process for Puerto Ricans to become American citizens. Then it declared Puerto Ricans statutorily as American citizens. That's kind of its own issue because it's not under the 14th Amendment. It's a statutory matter. But it did provide Puerto Ricans the opportunity to move to the United States and back and forth and have certain rights. So, yeah, that's kind of where it's been left. And what has been accepted is statehood.
So if Puerto Rico were to become a state, what about taxation of the individuals who live there?
Once it becomes a state, it's like every other state. So all of the rules would apply.
But what do they pay in taxes now? And how would that change if Puerto Rico became a state?
There are exemptions for Puerto Rico because it's not a state. Once it became a state, I think it would just be completely lined up with everybody else, right? It would be the same process. There are fears, you know, Democrats have been raising this about, you know, corporate entities in Puerto Rico or using Puerto Rico as a way to escape tax policies. Now, we do have, you know, Delaware has different tax policies than other states. States have the ability to do this. And Puerto Rico would have the ability to provide corporations tax benefits in the same way that New York City can and, you know, anywhere in the United States. But that's all left up to Puerto Rico. And to the degree that there are federal taxes, that would be the U.S. Congress. So that's all stuff that can be worked out.
So does the issue of Puerto Rican statehood divide congressional Democrats?
Right now it is. You know, AOC is wanting more evidence that Puerto Ricans support statehood. This also has a legacy related to race. Santo Domingo, you know, the Dominican Republic, was potentially brought in as a state in the 1870s. And Frederick Douglass, among others, had a very ambivalent, complicated relationship with the idea of, was this conquest or was this, you know, expanding democracy? And I think that's a similar argument going on among some Democrats right now with Puerto Rico. Do Puerto Ricans want to be a state, you know, part of the United States in this way? You know, is a really important question for a lot of Democrats. And I've noticed Schumer is, you know, bouncing back and forth on this.
And he's got problems because of Puerto Ricans who live in New York, and he's worried about those constituents.
Puerto Ricans, like all people, you know, are strongly, you know, protective of their nationhood. And I think for many Puerto Ricans, the idea of Puerto Rico remaining separate in some way, whether it's more meaningfully actual independence from the United States and a path towards independence. There's always been, you know, independence parties in Puerto Rico. They've been smaller, but they're there. Or maintaining the current status, it allows Puerto Rican citizens in New York and elsewhere different, you know, certain opportunities maybe that might not exist if that went away. So there's a host of reasons there, and Schumer seems to be listening to him. Even Marco Rubio seemed to be hedging a little more, although he has generally been in support of Puerto Rican statehood, you know, Florida being the other big state.
Puerto Rico also has some bankruptcy issues to deal with. How might they be affected were Puerto Rico to become a state?
You would think it would be a huge economic boost. More business, arguably, you know, more, you know, Puerto Rico would be incorporated into all sorts of things. So you would think that would be, you know, part of a big boost to Puerto Rico in certain ways. There's a lot of Americans, you know, in the current 50 states who, when they travel, they like to go to places that are part of the United States. Already, you don't need a passport, obviously, to go to Puerto Rico, but you would think that that would be a boon. But I mean, it would also, it would force the federal government much more strongly to intervene in Puerto Rico and make sure these issues are not ongoing, right? That Puerto Rico is sustained. Right now, because it's seen as a territory, the likes of Trump and others have labeled it as sort of this outcast and not, we don't have to actually deal with it. I mean, we saw that with the hurricane, right? I mean, if Puerto Rico was Louisiana or Mississippi, the reaction of the federal government would have been arguably quite different as opposed to Puerto Rico. It's kind of part of the United States, but it's not really part of the United States. And, you know, it's really their own problem, but we'll help them out.
So what happens next with D.C.?
Well, I presume the Democrats will pass it in the House. They go to the Senate. The Senate, other big question. Everyone's talking about filibuster, right? You know, so does this pass a filibuster? D.C.? I don't see it. There is, you know, arguably you could use reconciliation.
I thought you could only use reconciliation on financial matters.
Yeah, they're pretty creative. They can be creative. But that seems like a tough one. So I think it has to go through the filibuster. So there, you know, that's where Puerto Rico again looms. Could there be enough pressure put on enough Republicans like Marco Rubio that Puerto Rico coming in with D.C. might entice, it's not going to entice a majority of Republicans, but it might entice enough of them.
10 is what you need.
Yeah, 10. Yeah. And indeed, I mean, you've got a few Democrats that are going to be on the fence. So could that entice enough? I think that's hard. I think that's, you know, quite unlikely at this time. But I think if you see sustained, I mean, Black Lives Matter was an amazing, you know, profound moment and an opportunity. And I think an opportunity we haven't seen in a long time. That needs to be sustained and pushed forward. I think, you know, the idea of 700,000 Americans not being a part of a state, I think is something that resonates with people. But yeah, I think it's going to be a hard push. It's obviously a short window, or certainly looks like a short window as far as how long Democrats even have the majorities that they have. I'm not optimistic, but I see possibilities there. And again, I think, you know, a place like Puerto Rico could be a way to negotiate with some Republicans.
So eventually, not saying this year, not saying next year, but eventually, do you think both D.C. and Puerto Rico will achieve statehood?
I think D.C. has to. I don't see how it can keep going without being a state. Even if it was, you know, cut up and merged into Maryland and Virginia or something. But I don't think people want right now. But I don't see how it maintains itself over time, not as a state, assuming the population stays. I mean, if it goes back to the very beginning ideas that Washington would be a place that people show up for a few months, govern, and then go home for, you know, 6 months of the summer, is how they had it because there was no air conditioning, that might change. But no, I think D.C. needs to become a state. Puerto Rico, I think if Puerto Ricans continue, majorities want statehood, I think the same thing. And I think, again, you know, Puerto Rico in some ways has an easier time because there's more bipartisan support for Puerto Rico to become a state. So, yeah, I would say optimistically that before the 21st century is over, that we would see the two come in, you know, probably I would think of somewhat of a package. Or if D.C. comes in, then you would see a lot of push towards Puerto Rico.
That's a pretty long prognostication.
That is. I'm covering my bets here. I think before then. But am I optimistic right now? I do think it will happen. What you see with a lot of these fights is there's a big fight, it loses, a big fight, it loses. And then often there's just sort of a moment and it swoops in. You know, you're probably going to need some more Democrats in office. And here, well, you know, where I will say to the Republicans, you know, give them credit. I mean, neither party wants the other party to bring in a new state, right, with such a partisan imbalance. Now, we do have precedent for it. Republicans did this in the 1880s and 1890s. I mean, the whole West, they were bringing in. They were the dominant party. They brought in these areas. They didn't actually predict right on some of them. Some of them, they thought a lot of them were Republican. Turned out a bunch of them became Democrat. So I do think this is inevitable, but I've thought a lot of things are inevitable, that here we are in 2021, that we're still fighting over. So the rigidity of the United States, is there's power there. Again, I'm optimistic, but with some hesitance.
Thank you, Paul. Good to talk with you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've written in to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Bruntenberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Allison Brody, and Sandra Baker. Thanks for listening, all. Be well, stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.